Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
I am really, really, really so excited for the opportunity to be your NCLEX instructor. Let's get right into our class. It is diabetes time. So before we begin into the pharmacology, let's review. Okay. Now I put this document in your workbook so that you can read it, but I'll just break it down for you as well. When we're talking about diabetes mellitus, there are two very important organs that help with the regulation of your blood glucose. And those organs are the pancreas. You can write this down. The pancreas, which produces insulin, okay, and then also the liver, okay, which produces and stores glucose, okay, in the form of glycogen. And so this is really significant as well, storing that glucose, storing that glycogen, because that is what helps to bring the blood sugar levels down, okay. And so when you talk about the regulation of blood glucose here with insulin, the idea is that you bring the blood glucose levels down. So here's a scenario. Typically, say you eat a big bowl of rice, right? We all love rice. However, when you consume the rice, it gets broken down, okay, into glucose. And so that glucose is floating around in your bloodstream, and it's going to raise your blood glucose levels. So you have the rice breaks down to glucose. It's in the bloodstream. Your levels are up. So the pancreas says, hey, I need to produce some insulin. I need to produce some insulin to help get rid of this excess glucose. So when the insulin is produced, it arrives on the scene. The insulin says to the liver, hey, store some of this glucose, get it out of here. The insulin also says that to the muscles as well, because your muscles can store glucose. So the insulin is telling the organs, hey, you got to help me out here. And so that is how the liver is able to store glucose. It's why it's such a big help. And it's why the muscles are such a big help too in maintaining the blood glucose levels. So it all works together. But remember, I've been saying since class one, anatomy is how you understand pharmacology. So let's get into now our insulin therapy. All right. So the goal of insulin therapy is to reduce blood glucose levels. It's to reduce blood glucose levels. And the normal value of your blood glucose is 70 to 110. So I have that written down there for you. All right. So I do want to talk about the oral antidiabetics first before I go into the insulins. And so A will be the oral antidiabetics. Okay, so put that down in your box. Also, remember that whenever we are talking about pills to control the blood sugar levels, this is in regards to diabetes mellitus type 2, all right? Diabetes mellitus type 2 only can take these pills, all right? And so if you need to review the different types of diabetes mellitus type 1 and type 2, please do so, so that you can have a better understanding. If you're in the virtual trainer, I go over this this specific reason as well in there. So the pills are used with dietary modifications. Okay. So it's a what you call an adjunct therapy. If you ever heard of an adjunct therapy, it's because it's used with something else. Okay. All right. So we're talking about the pills here. So there are three classifications that I want to go into. The first one, very common. All right. They're called the sulfonylureas. Okay. Now, these medications are so great at controlling diabetes mellitus because they stimulate the pancreas to release more insulin. Okay? They stimulate the pancreas to release more insulin. And so we know that that's going to be helpful in controlling the blood glucose levels. All right. Now, what are some medication examples I have here already for you? Glipizide, glimepiride, gliburide. All right. So very common when I hear them, when I say them, I know that I'm talking about medications to control the blood glucose levels. Now, somewhere on the paper there, I want you guys to write down the side effects, okay? Because this was important for patient teaching. All right. So you need to know that this class of medication increases that insulin secretion. All right. Stimulates the pancreas. Yes, 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 yes. But it can cause weight gain. Yeah. If you give glipizide, it can cause your patient to have weight gain. Okay. Also, of course, hypoglycemia. Because what are these medications going to do? What are these medications going to do to your blood sugar levels? They're going to bring them down, 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 down. Okay. And also, because this medication has a sulfur base, you do not want to give it if a sulfur allergy is present. And so that's easy to remember because the beginning, right, the prefix are going to be quite similar here. All right. Awesome. So this is one class of oral anti-diabetics. Okay. Now, the second class, okay, the second class is the biguanides. Okay. And these medications, there's only one that we use. But these medications, what they do is they suppress the amount of glucose that the liver makes. Because remember, I told you the glucose, it produces and it stores glucose. So the liver produces and it stores glucose, right? So this medication, right, it suppresses the amount of glucose that the liver makes. And the most popular example is going to be metformin. Typically, if you are diagnosed with diabetes mellitus type 2, one of the first medications that you will be prescribed is metformin. Very, very common for this type of condition. All right. And it is the only biguanide that we use. However, metformin can actually cause weight loss. Yeah. Metformin can actually cause weight loss and a vitamin B12 deficiency. Mm-hmm. Yep. We also don't want to use metformin in clients with liver, kidney, or heart failure. Okay. We want to avoid this particular medication, particularly in clients with liver failure, because we know it's going to affect the liver, right? And so kidney and heart failure as well are precautions. Now, the third medication that you want to know is the bile acid sequestrants. And typically, this medication is given to reduce cholesterol. That's what it's for. Okay. So this is, it's an atypical medication in terms of the initial indication of what it does. So it's going to reduce cholesterol, but it also can reduce Okay, the blood glucose levels. Okay, and so especially through the liver, right? So it helps to reduce again the production of glucose by the liver. And it's mainly given, I forgot to say that when you talk about the cholesterol, it's given to lower the LDL, okay, which is the bad cholesterol. So the medication that's there is cholestyramine, all right? And that is the only one that you would need to know for NCLEX, okay? That is the only one that you need to know for NCLEX. So easy, easy, easy peasy right here. However, this medication can cause constipation, nausea, indigestion. And a funny thing about this medication is that although it will lower your LDL, okay, your cholesterol, it is known to increase triglycerides. Isn't that funny? And so there is a lot of teaching with this particular medication, okay? All right. Now, let's go into our insulins that we are going to be injecting. Our insulins that we're going to be injecting. And so for part B, we're going to be looking at treatment for diabetes mellitus type 1 and type 2. Okay? We're going to be looking for treatment of diabetes mellitus type 1 and type 2. Now, there are two groups of insulin, because that's what we're talking about. The two major groups of insulin are bolus and basal, or basal bolus, right? Do you know the difference between a bolus insulin and a basal insulin? All right. And I'm hoping that a lot of you here are going to learn some new things today. Like I'm just really, you know, I'm really excited to share this information because you may not have gotten it in nursing school. I'm just going to keep it real. You may not have learned this in nursing school. So, but it's important for our state board exams. So we're going to talk about the difference between bolus and basal insulin. Now let's start with number one. Get your paper out. We're gonna start with number one, and on that line there, you can just put bolus because that is what we're gonna start with. We're gonna start with the bolus insulins. So go ahead and write that down. Now, there are goals when you give a patient insulin, right? There is a reason why you're choosing one type of insulin over another. So the two goals for a bolus insulin, okay, the two goals for your bolus insulin are number one, to lower high blood sugar, okay? This insulin is given to bring the blood glucose levels down, all right? And it's typically given with a sliding scale. So you give a certain amount based off of what your client's blood glucose level is. So this is how you would interact with bolus insulin. You give it to lower high blood sugars in general. And then two, you give it to cover your patient's food. This insulin is what helps keep the blood sugar in check when you are consuming carbohydrates, because carbohydrates can really raise your blood sugar level within 10 minutes, you know? So if your patient is a diabetic, they already have issues with their blood sugar being high, and in front of them is a breakfast tray with pancakes, pineapples cut up, you know, scrambled eggs, we're gonna need to give this patient something. And so the bolus insulin is going to help to cover all of the carbohydrates that they are going to consume, right? Because the bolus insulin is going to work pretty quickly. So how many times a day is this insulin administered? Usually three times a day. before breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Okay, this is when you give it, or you can give it, you know, right when the client has food there. All right. So this is the bolus insulin. Let's talk about the two types. All right. And they are essentially your rapid acting insulins. So insulin aspart, insulin lispro is considered a bolus insulin. And that makes sense because we know that it works pretty quickly. And we give it with meals to keep the blood sugar levels maintained. Also, short-term insulin or regular insulin is considered the bolus type of insulin. And so now we have an understanding of why we're giving these particular class of insulins. All right. So sometimes it goes beyond just, you know, memorizing the onset, peak, and duration, which, you know, I could tell you guys about. But do you understand why one insulin is more appropriate over another? Okay, that's the deep studying that we're doing tonight. So you may get something like this on NCLEX where you are presented an exhibit, okay, such as this one, and it is essentially a sliding scale. So if you've never seen a sliding scale before, this is what that physician's order will look like. You will have a range of blood glucose levels on one side, and then you will have the amount of insulin in units to give on another. And if this was, you know, a proper prescription, it would say administer, you know, regular insulin or whatever have you. But for the purposes of this activity, it's not important which type of insulin. What is important is the number of units that you know to give. So if we're looking at the activity, it says how many units of insulin, if you're reading from your worksheet, how many units of insulin, if any, should be administered based on the client's current blood glucose reading and the prescribed sliding scale from the chart above. So the first reading is done at 7 in the morning. Okay, 7 in the morning. So we have the insulin reading is 225. So based off of the client's blood glucose reading, how much insulin do you expect to give that client? Well, the correct answer here would be 5 units. And so you're going to want to be able to do this on your NCLEX exam. All right. So again, the 1145, the blood sugar reading is now 500. So at this point, how much insulin do you give this client, if any? If any, what say if you guys? All right. So some answers could be we shouldn't give anything. We should call a physician because there is a you know, a little letter next to the number of the highest range. And it seems like this 500 is out of range. So what do you do? If I'm going by the prescribed sliding scale, I would give 15 units and then I would contact the physician because that is what this says. Okay. And so this sliding scale here has a treatment for the nurse to do before contacting the physician. And so it is expected that you would carry out what is written here and then call the physician. All right. So based off of the sliding scale, that is what is appropriate to do. Let's do the last one here. It says then 1745, the client's blood glucose level is now 122. So how many units of insulin do we give? Well, we should not be giving any. Okay. So if you feel comfortable with this particular activity, you will be able to pass this type of competency on your NCLEX RN or NCLEX PN exam. And so that's a beautiful thing because, to be honest, I think when I was in nursing school, I had not given insulin on a sliding scale during nursing school. You know, some clinicals are very limited, so you don't get to do everything. Like, I didn't get to see a baby being born during my OB rotation, you know. So I didn't get to start an IV during nursing school at all. I didn't learn that stuff until I actually got a job on the unit. So there may be some experiences that you just miss out on during nursing school, and that's okay. You will definitely learn it in the real world, I promise you. So let's talk about the second class of insulins, and that is the basal insulin. So how do basal insulins differ from the bolus insulin? Well, the two goals of administering a basal insulin are to provide a background insulin. So background insulin is just insulin while the client is at rest. They're not doing anything, okay? It's just to maintain a certain number of blood sugar levels, right? So that's the basal. That is the basal insulin. Now, another goal is to understand that basal insulin is not affected by your meals. Okay, so it's not going to cover you. It's not going to cover, you know, the pizza that you had right away. It's not working like that. Okay, so how many times a day is this insulin administered? You usually see basal insulin given once or twice a day, depending on the severity of the client's condition. And so I'm going to tell you guys the two types of basal insulins that we currently have, and that is the intermediate and the long acting. So the MPH or insulin glargine, these would be considered basal insulins. And you know, usually with the insulin glargine, the long acting insulin, you give that at night once a day. Now, I did have a client who was taking his twice a day. So once or twice a day is the expected administration times for the basal insulin. Okay, so now you guys know the difference between bolus and basal insulin. And so that can be removed from your studying in terms of, let me just look up the definition. All right. So we got that down. So I want to do, let me see here. I want to do two more. I want to do two more. So the next insulin that I want to talk about, okay, you guys stay with me. We are learning tonight. We are learning. All right. So the next insulin that I want to talk about is the premixed insulin. Okay, it's the premixed insulin, and this insulin can definitely show up on your board exams because it's really common, and there's a benefit to using a premixed solution. So the goals of the premixed insulin is to provide the patient at the same time both kinds of coverage. So you can give the bolus and the basal. All right, you can give the bolus and the basal because, to be honest, you know, once your diabetes gets to a certain point, you usually need both to control it. So this also will allow the patient to have fewer shots due to combined insulin instead of, you know, multiples of two kinds. And this is important because, you know, your bolus and your basal insulin might be scheduled differently. And so you can't always give them at the same time. So if your patient can have reduced shots, then that makes them feel better and allows them to be more compliant with their medication. So how many times a day is this insulin given? Typically once or twice daily, okay, for that pre-mixed insulin. Pre-mixed insulin. Now, what are the types of the premixed insulin and what do the numbers mean here? So, there are two types. There is the 70-30, which is really common. And then there's also a 50-50 premixed. OK, Okay. So again, if we're talking about the premix 70-30 or the premix 50-50, we know that this is a combination of regular and intermediate insulin. Okay. Yep. So students always ask this, or they're confused about it, or they just don't quite get it in nursing school. Like, what do the numbers represent? What does 70 represent? What does 30 represent? You know, of which insulin do they come from? So the first number that you see will always represent the long lasting insulin. So this is our basal insulin. This is the intermediate MPH insulin. Okay, so that's, so if we're reading the box right now, it says 70% is MPH. And then the second number is going to represent the regular insulin amount. So the box tells you as well, hey, 30% of this solution is made up of regular insulin. So, whew, all right, that's underway. All right, so you guys can see, Just going over the information first makes you feel so much proficient to answer questions that you will encounter if you're doing an NCLEX questionnaire, okay? And this is the reason why our method at Remar Review is content first and then questions later, because it really makes you a more, it really just makes you a more intelligent nurse, and you feel more confident and well-rounded. This is what you need to pass NCLEX, okay? So the last thing that I want to talk about is the insulin pumps, okay? Lots of questions, lots of misconceptions, or just a lack of understanding about these insulin pumps. Now, what I want to say is that remember when you talk about the insulin pumps, that insulin pumps can be used for type 1 diabetes, type 2, and even gestational diabetes. This is a device that is applicable to cover all the different types of diabetes mellitus, right? So what do we have here? Before we talk about the critically thinking things about it, let's just go over the administration, the parts of it. And so I like this picture that I have here, because it literally shows you, you know, the actual device, the needle that's used, the cannula. Like, this is what the insulin pump consists of. So it is programmable. Okay. Meaning that you can set the amount of insulin that your patient will get. It is usually placed in the same location that you would do a subcutaneous injection. All right. It is placed usually in the abdomen or the thigh, but it just stays there. It stays there. Okay. Now, the cannula to deliver the insulin is usually changed every 48 to 72 hours. And so that's about 2 or 3 days worth of insulin. All right. Cause that's all that this machine can basically hold. So you're going to be changing it out about every 2 to 3 days. Okay. And this little device is battery operated. So, you know, thinking about what are the indications of having a battery operated machine. Okay. What would it mean for your patient in terms of restrictions, things that they would have to check for? Whenever you're changing batteries for any type of device, like this insulin pump, hearing aids, what else requires batteries that patients use? Whatever kind of the small device that a patient would use, Never put in cold batteries. Okay. That's just an insider tip. If the batteries are cold, they should not be used. The battery should be room temperature, because cold batteries can sometimes not function well, right? So they may start off really great, but then they won't function well. All right. So now we can go to the other part of our worksheet that talks about exactly some of the things that we were supposed to think about. All right. So it's a small computerized external device. Okay. Now, this is the size of a pager. This is the size of a pager. Now, the question asks here, what organ does the machine mimic? Well, the insulin pump is going to mimic the pancreas because it is our pancreas that produces insulin. So the insulin pump will now give your patient the pancreas function that it doesn't have. All right. So the insulin pump is going to be giving your patient the insulin that it doesn't have. And why is this? Why is this the best method for those with poorly controlled diabetes? Well, it's simply because the pump is going to work nonstop. Okay. The pump is going to work nonstop. So there's less of an issue about medication noncompliance because you don't have to do anything. If you wear it, you will get the required medication that you're supposed to. If you're monitoring yourself and you're wearing your insulin pump, the medication should be delivered. So the next questions on your worksheet are, should the client take it off at night? Okay. So I want you to think about it. Should your client take their insulin pump off at night? What do you think? Also on your worksheets, it says, will this machine take the blood glucose levels? What do you think? All right. These are all great select all then apply questions on NCLEX about the insulin pump. All right. And then, how many types of insulin are in the pump? Are you getting your rapid acting? Are you getting your basal? Are you getting are you getting the premixed? Are you getting them all in one? How many types of insulin are in this pump? Okay. So these are the questions the students encounter in NCLEX and they're like, what? I don't even know. I haven't even studied. I don't know. So we're going to talk about it here. Quickly, the answer, should the client take it off at night? No, 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 no. All right, we're going to keep it on because the pump works nonstop. So if you take it off at night, there is a risk of hyperglycemia happening. Your blood sugar levels will go up because there's no insulin. All right, and then does the machine take the client's blood glucose levels? So no, the ones on NCLEX, they do not. I did read that they're coming out with some new ones that are able to do that. But for the purpose of our state boards, the answer is no. The client still must take their own blood sugar levels. How many types of insulin are in the pump? Well, you guys saw it. There is only one type of insulin that will be delivered in this pump. Okay. And then how often does the blood glucose levels need to be checked? They need to be checked at least 4 times a day. So that's before every meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and before you go to bed, all right? And then sometimes I was reading that people even have to take their blood sugar levels up to 8 times a day when they're first starting their insulin pumps, okay? So great information here. Battery operated insulin pumps. I mean, if you haven't seen this picture before, I would really just settle into it. Watch this video again if you need to. But this is very important for you to know because a lot of diabetics require the insulin pump now. Okay, so we studied the content. Let's go over some questions that are found in your workbook. And the first question is, this is a really good one. Okay, the nurse is discharging a client newly diagnosed with diabetes mellitus type 2. Which statement, if made by the client, requires follow-up teaching? And all of my questions have been like this. We're looking for the one that needs the teaching done. So number one says, I will use my sliding scale when administering my premixed 70-30 insulin. Two, I will check my blood glucose levels every night before going to bed. Three, if my casual blood glucose levels are decreasing over time, my medication may be adjusted. 4, insulin therapy will help reduce my risk of going blind. So, which statement requires follow-up teaching? In other words, which one is wrong? Okay. And if we're looking at these choices, we have to pick the best choice in front of us when we're taking NCLEX. That would be obviously number one. When you're on a pre-mixed 70-30 insulin, there shall be no sliding scale. Okay. You have no flexibility. You should not be looking to change that dose at all. All right. So the other choices are all correct. They make sense and they are appropriate for this client with diabetes mellitus type 2. Let's look at the next one here. I like it. It says this: a client is initiating insulin pump therapy. Which of the following statements, if made by the client, requires follow-up education? Again, now this is a select all that apply. All right. So we know about insulin pump therapy. I told you guys about it. All right. And we're looking for the wrong statement. So number one says, I can keep my pump on during a shower, but not a bath. 2, I no longer need to carry injectable insulin as my pump will deliver my insulin needs. 3, I will disconnect my pump during my 30-minute jogging routine to prevent hypoglycemia. 4, I will check my battery life often so that my pump continues to deliver insulin. Or 5, I can receive continuous and bolus doses of the same insulin from my pump. Okay. So we're looking for the statements that require follow-up education. What do you guys say? What do you say? All right. The answers are rolling in. You might have them in your head. I'm going to show them to you. They are 1, 2, and 3. We're going to have to follow up with these statements because they got some issues. All right. So number one says, I can keep my pump on during a shower, but not a bath. So instances where you need to take your pump off, all right, are going to be water related activities. All right. Cause this is a battery operated machine. So, if your patient is showering or bathing, they're going to need to disconnect that insulin pump. If they're swimming, if they're in a jacuzzi, if they're water skiing, you got to take it off. Okay. 2 says, I no longer need to carry injectable insulin as my pump will deliver my insulin needs. And so this is a dangerous assumption because there's a chance that your pump can malfunction. And so you need to have insulin at your disposal, injectable insulin, to cover the insulin needs. If your pump malfunctions, you can't go without it, particularly if you're a type 1 diabetic, right? 3 says, I will disconnect my pump during my daily 30-minute jogging routine to prevent hypoglycemia. All right. So you do not disconnect the pump during exercises or non-water related activities. Any other time of the day, you need to have that pump on. All right. And side note, because I know I'll get an email about this. We do know that exercise does lower the blood glucose levels. And so, some students might be thinking, well, if exercise is lowering my blood glucose levels, do I really need to have my insulin pump going? And so my response to that is, Insulin pumps can be adjusted. Remember, they're programmable. So instead of the client disconnecting or taking off their insulin, it would be appropriate for the insulin to be readjusted by the client, or the healthcare provider would give those parameters to what to do with the insulin, as opposed to just the client saying, I'm going to take it off. All right. Okay. Number four says, I will check my battery life often so that my pump continues to deliver insulin. So this is a correct statement. We don't need to follow up with that. We do want them to check their battery life often. And number five might have tricked some people, but it literally is saying, I can receive continuous and bolus doses of the same insulin from my pump. And that is actually correct. You can have a programmed pump that will deliver continuous insulin. So if your patient gets 2 units an hour, right, that pump will deliver two units an hour of regular insulin, right? And then it also can give you a bolus dose. It also can give you a bolus dose if you need it. So if you need 5 units of regular insulin because you just ate a pizza that was not on the menu, you know, of your dietary menu, then that pump can deliver you 5 units of regular insulin, but it's the same insulin. It's the same insulin. So that statement was true. I can receive continuous and bolus doses of the same insulin from my pump, because remember, there's only one type of insulin in that pump. All right, question number three says, again, it's no surprise here, which of the following statements, if made by the client, requiring insulin therapy, require follow-up teaching? So which of the following statements, if made by the client, requiring insulin therapy, require follow-up education? And the choices are, number one, I will inject my insulin in the subcutaneous fat within 1 inch of my navel. 2, I should check insulin vial for contamination. 3, I will inject my insulin at a 90 degree angle. 4, insulin aspart is my rapid acting insulin. So if we're looking at these four choices, the best one in front of us to pick that requires follow-up education is going to be number one. Yes, that is going to be inappropriate for the client to do as far as injecting insulin within 1 inch of the navel, because the belly button area is tougher, right? And it's difficult for the medication to absorb there. So it'll be less consistent. It should be at least 2 inches, the injection site, from the umbilical cord or the navel. Okay. Okay. We got a whole nother subject to cover. I promised I was bringing you total parenteral nutrition. Oh my goodness. If you are in the virtual trainer, again, you're really going to love this, this presentation of TPN. We're going to start by just acknowledging what nutrition is. All right. So you can write this down on your worksheet. Nutrition, or aliment, is the necessary nourishment to the body's cells to support life. So your nutrition is essential for your overall health. Okay. Now, there are different types of nutrition. So we're going to go over the three here, and I promise you, you'll have a better understanding of them by the end of this lecture. So number one, you have your oral nutrition. And this chart is for my visual learners. You guys know, I try to cater to every kind of learner. So my visual learners, you have your three, and they're in a tier. So of course, the most prominent, the one we want the most of, we want everybody eating orally. Yes, it's at the top of the list. All right. Two, the second one is the enteral nutrition. If you have to avoid your mouth, we can put the medication directly into the stomach if we have to. All right. But it's not the best for the process. All right. So you have your intro nutrition, and then three is kind of like the final effort, and that is the parenteral nutrition. It can be done. It is done quite often, but there's definitely disadvantages. So let's get more into it in terms of nutritional support. Let's kind of go a little bit further for my writers and my readers like myself. So if we're talking about nutritional support in the client education, number one, it's pretty simple. For your oral nutrition, this of course is the preferred. It's the preferred delivery of nutrition, okay? You're able to get your solids, your liquids. It's very effective. And most importantly, it's non-invasive. We do not have to break any sterile cavities, you know what I mean, in order to feed you. And so this is important, right? So this is the best way for somebody to get nutrition. Now, the intro nutritional support, there's a lot that's going on. So you have nutrition that is essentially all liquid, because remember, we're not going to be putting any solids through here. So if you move out of the oral nutrients, you're losing your ability to consume solid foods. That's another issue. But the nutrition is going to be placed through the nose, the esophagus, the stomach, and the intestines. Okay. All right. So, I mean, imagine the food that you're eating going through your nose right now. How is that going to feel? I mean, you know, you have a catheter, but it's not the most natural, of course. So you have nutrition placed through the nose, the esophagus, the stomach, or intestines. And some of you may have had this done. You got to have a functioning GI tract. In order for this to work, your gastrointestinal tract has to be functioning. And again, if the person can tolerate oral feedings, that needs to come first. The short-term methods of intro feeding are the nasal gastric tube. All right. And then if it's going to be a longer process, then a surgery needs to be done where you're getting the G tube. All right. The gastrostomy tube, and that's going directly into the stomach. Or you're going to get the jejunostomy tube. And that is the going from the stomach into the small intestines. All right. And so these are long-term feeding solutions for our clients. All right. Intro nutrition. Okay. Did you learn something here? Let's look at the parenteral nutrition. It's called total parenteral nutrition, because it can provide you your complete nutrition. Surprisingly, you can get all your micro and macronutrients from this solution. And so, you know, that makes it pretty effective. All right. But it is only used for disorders where there is no GI tract available for use. So your patient has to be on, a complete bowel rest. So, you know, examples of that are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. If you're not familiar with these, if you can't explain these in 2 minutes, each one of them, you got to look it up. Get in your quick facts book. Okay. Get in your quick facts book for you guys. You know, you might be joining me for the first time. Quick facts for NCLEX will straighten those two subjects out for you. Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. They are very common conditions. Your board exam expects you to know them. Okay. And when we talk about the routes of the parenteral nutrition, they can be given PPN, which is through a peripheral vein. Okay. Or they can be given TPN, which is through the central line placement. And so I believe if we're looking at the picture on your worksheet, you have an example of the TPN, the PPN, the NG tube, right? the G tube and the jejunostomy tube, right? So they're all there for you guys. Okay. Now, when we talk about total parenteral nutrition, because we're going to get more into it here, let's focus on getting the patient started, okay, and what needs to be done, because there are steps before you do this. Remember, this total parenteral nutrition, this is supplying all of your patient's nutrition through an intravenous route. And with TPN, we know that that is a major, all right, that is a major vein that that medication is going through. So when you're starting TPN, typically the solution is refrigerated, like blood, right? So it comes from the refrigerator. It has to stay cold. And so you must remove it from the refrigerator at least 2 hours before the start time. Now, I saw some that says 1 hour. I saw some that even said 6 hours. So you may see a different reference number depending on your hospital facility policies. But the idea is that you want this solution to be room temperature. Okay. All right. Number two says gradually initiate over 2 days. So that means when you first give TPN, you don't give the full amount in the first day. Can anybody think of a reason why you would only, on the first day, give half of the required amount? There's a reason. If you think about what TPN is made of, what it's mostly made of, right? So the reason why you don't want to give it all in the first day is because you have to monitor your patient for that hyperglycemia. They're going to definitely experience that. Also, you want to see how they are tolerating this new solution into their veins. So number two says gradually initiate over 2 days. So by the second day, your patient should be tolerating the full prescribed amount. Okay, perfect. Three, total parenteral nutrition is a continuous infusion that is not usually stopped. So once you're on TPN, it's running. And the solution lasts, it was 24 hours. All right. So it's good for about 24 hours outside of the refrigerator. And then you have to change it. Okay. Change it and change the tubing too, as well, if I need to say that. Four, the great thing about TPN is that literally it is total. So there are usually no additional fluids that are needed for your patient. So your total parenteral nutrition can provide you the water that you need, and it can provide you all the macro and micronutrients all in one solution. So you don't need to also hydrate your patient when they're on TPN as well. All right. So the question here about TPN, critically thinking about it, does the client need to sign an informed consent? What do you guys think? If you are, if you are suggested for total parenteral nutrition in the hospital, would an informed consent need to be signed? Hey, absolutely. Yes, this is a medical procedure. This is a medical intervention. You definitely need to have an informed consent. The doctor needs to do that, though. That's not the nurse's. You guys know how I get on my hobby horse about this. It is not the nurse's job to get that informed consent. It is the doctor's job to do it. Nurses only sign as witnesses. Okay? We only sign as witnesses. Let the doctors do their job. The next critical thinking question says, if TPN has added calcium and lipids, should the nurse expect particles in the formula? Okay. So is it okay to have particles in the formula if lipids are added or other electrolytes? What do you guys think? The answer is No. Anytime you see particles in a formula, that indicates separation. Okay. The formula is not all together, so we do not want to give that to our patients. We don't want to give that to them in their central veins, right? So that's not going to be appropriate. We wouldn't give that solution. Okay, so we know about starting TPN. We critically think through some scenarios. Now let's talk about stopping TPN. What does that look like? Well, it's kind of straightforward when you talk about this solution, because like other medications that raise your blood sugar and cause your body to respond in a certain way, you cannot just cut off TPN. It gradually has to be reduced. So your patient is weaned off. Okay. And that is to avoid hypoglycemia. Okay. That's to avoid hypoglycemia. Now, if TPN runs out, you guys know that this can be a very common, NCLEX scenario. Your patient's on TPN and it runs out. What do you do? Well, we give our 10% dextrose. All right. 10% dextrose, and you give it at the same rate as the TPN was going. So if the TPN was going, 45 milliliters an hour, if you hang that dextrose, you're going to give it at 45 milliliters an hour. Okay. Okay. All right. Now, number three, clients need to have at least 75% of their calorie needs by oral or enteral feedings before stopping TPN. Okay. And this is a great transition principle. You don't want to just stop TPN without another source of nutrition being, available to your client. All right. Now, of course, anytime you are going to be accessing sterile spaces into your patient, you know that there's going to be some complications. And so for TPN, there are several that I want you to know. Air embolism is one of them. And if you got, I'm listing these complications, but I'm not going to define them. I'm not going to go over the complications individually. I want you guys to look that up because this is med surge. All right. So air embolism, you need to know what it is. I have a picture for you right here, but you need to understand what's happening and what's the treatment. Okay. Sepsis. What does that mean for your patient? A pneumothorax. How can that happen? All right. Bleeding. Okay, pretty straightforward there. And then intravenous access local infection. All right. And that just makes sense because anytime you are breaking a sterile field with something from the outside, then there is a chance of infection. And so we got to remember that our bodies, although they're outside, I mean, the outside of our bodies, they interact with the environment. And I'll go back to the slide in a second. They interact with their environment. The inside of a lot of our body is sterile. So when I say it's sterile, that means it's free from any bacteria. So for example, inside of your veins, sterile. Inside of your bladder where your urine is, yes, that's sterile. There should be no bacteria present in the bladder. There should be no bacteria present in the heart, in the lungs. You know, these are all sterile cavities. And so if we're talking about putting a catheter in a central vein that is sterile, how much do we need to monitor that? You know, and so we can't take things lightly when we insert a urinary catheter, because you're inserting it into a sterile space. That's why we have to use all that betadine. You know, when we insert an IV, sometimes, and you know, as nurses, we get very casual in things that we do, but we are supposed to do our patients no harm. And little things like a catheter can really cause a patient to suffer, okay? Suffer serious hospital complications. So, speaking of blood drawing and laboratory catheters and, you know, sterile spaces in the veins, what are the TPN lab requirements? What blood samples need to be drawn? And so daily you would do a capillary glucose reading. Yeah, a capillary glucose reading. And we know that that is the indication of her, of her blood glucose levels. Weekly, you would do a sodium level. And I'm sorry, you guys got to write all this down, but it is helpful. And you need to know the abbreviations of each one of these. So I shouldn't even really say them, but I'm trusting that you know them. You need to do a sodium, a potassium, a chloride, a BUN, a creatinine, right? A calcium, magnesium, hemoglobin, hematocrit, white blood cell count for your patient, liver functions, and triglycerides. Because you're getting all of your nutrition from this solution. And so your electrolytes can be altered very quickly. And I have here underneath all of those laboratory values that in the beginning of your treatment, you're going to get these blood draws every day. Yeah, you're going to get these blood draws every day. And then once you're maintained on the TPN, they'll do them weekly. And then monthly, because total parenteral nutrition can reduce like your bone mineralization, you got to get a bone density test if you're on it longer than 3 months, or if you haven't maintained adequate nutrition over 3 months. Okay. All right. Okay. So TPN. Presented to you as simply as I possibly could in order for you to be proficient for your board exams. Now, I'm telling you, if you have your virtual trainer workbook, I also go over TPN, giving you another perspective of this medical treatment. So I am excited to see how you put both of them together and have this amazing understanding. But for right now, it's time for our questions because we did the content. So the first question coming at you is all about TPN. It's all about nutrition, right? Is this, it says, the nurse is caring for a client who requires supplemental nutrition. The client is only consuming 10% of their daily requirements orally. Which of the following is the most appropriate form of nutrition at this time? Is it number one, a liquid diet with a smooth consistency? Two, tube feeding? Three, peripheral parenteral nutrition? Or four, total parenteral nutrition? This will make you think. Go ahead and go with your first mind. What is the most appropriate form of nutrition for this patient? It is going to be, it's going to be the tube feeding. Why is it the tube feeding? Well, simply this. What does this client have that they're eating orally? They have a functioning GI tract. And because of that, because they are functioning, because they have a functioning GI tract, because they're eating orally, then I know that number three and number four are not going to be appropriate for them. Okay. Anybody that can eat orally, I don't want to introduce TPN for them. Now it says the client is only consuming. So they're only eating 10% of their daily requirements. Now I don't know. It could be a dentures problem. They could have a tooth abscess. I don't know. They could have sores, a lockjaw, whatever. But I know that they have the ability to eat. So I am going to bypass their mouth and I'm going to get that food right to where it needs to go to. So I'm going to do that with a tube feeding through the nose. If I have to go through the stomach, I don't think I do. But tube feeding is going to be the next step, all right, for this client. The liquid diet with a smooth consistency, I'm not going to try to give them more oral foods if I know that they're not meeting their requirements on an oral diet alone. I need to escalate it. I need to prepare for the doctor to say, what is the next level? Because sometimes the doctor will ask you as the nurse. Okay. So I hope that one is clear. I hope we can all agree on that one. Number two is, it's a bit tougher. It's a bit tougher. And I was so happy when I wrote it because I was like, this is going to cause them to think. So number two says, the healthcare provider informs the nurse that a client's food must be pre-digested as a part of the nutritional plan. Which of the following food options would be most appropriate? Select all that apply. Okay. All right. So is it number one, mashed potatoes? Two, ensure ready to drink nutritional shake. Three, a mechanical soft blended meal plan. Four, Jevity 1.2 calorie high protein intro nutrition with fiber. Or five, Clinimix with electrolytes, parenteral central line infusion. Okay, so here we are talking about a solution that is pre-digested. The patient needs food that's pre-digested. So what would that be? And this is select all that apply. So one or more could be correct. One or more. All right. So the correct answer here, because we're looking for a food that is pre-digested, that means it doesn't have to have any contact with the GI tract to absorb it, the stomach, the intestines. The only solution is going to be number five, the parenteral central line. It is pre-digested. It is ready to go. The body can use it as it is. Everything else, the mashed potatoes, has to go through the gastrointestinal tract. That nutritional shake is oral. Got to get it through the GI tract. The mechanical soft blended food is a meal plan. Nope. And then even the intro nutrition, it has to go through the stomach into the small intestine. So number five, one answer is correct. All right. Okay. Let's do number three, shall we? Are you guys ready for three? All right. Okay. I know that was a good question. I really challenged you guys with that one. Three, the nurse is caring for a client who started total parenteral nutrition 10 days ago. The client has experienced a 1 kilogram per day weight gain. Which of the following should the nurse expect? Okay. All right. Number one, liver failure. Two, fluid overload. Three, renal failure. Or four, dehydration. Okay. And I love this. It's not a follow-up education. It is simply a nurse being able to evaluate what's happening, all right, to their patient. What do you think about this client? What are they experiencing? The nurse should absolutely expect fluid overload. That's right. That's right. Fluid overload. Okay. Because the client is getting some additional fluids. Now, you guys know how I love NCLEX activities. So I put an NCLEX activity page in your workbook. So I want to do it with you. Let's go. All right. And so essentially with this NCLEX activity page, and I put it in here. So based off of the client's information, which nutrition is going to be best? All right. So this is another way that I like to challenge my REMAR nurses to determine that they are competent in the subject. So we have here, the requirement is we're looking for a reduced risk of infection or sepsis. So what is going to be better, intro nutrition or TPN? What say if you guys write it down right now, share this video if you love NCLEX activities. All right. So intro nutrition, of course, is going to be better. It's going to be better for our patient. Now, number two says this. If we want a large variety of formula choices, what is going to be best? Is it enteral or is it TPN? The correct answer is yes, enteral nutrition. There are so many types of formula choices for enteral nutrition. It is going to be best for your patient here. Number three says this, which one reduces GI tube obstruction? All right. Gastrointestinal tube obstruction. Well, that is going to be, yes, the TPN, because it will totally eliminate the need for the gastrointestinal tract. So if you have complications there, you'll want to go to TPN. Four. Hey, you guys know this one. I told you several times, which one provides complete nutritional support? It is going to be TPN. Yes, total. It's total parenteral nutrition. Five says, which one is best for short-term use? Which one is going to be best for short-term use? And for short-term use, it's going to be TPN. TPN, although it can provide you all the nutrients you need, it is very hard on the body, particularly the liver that now has to metabolize food. You guys know that's not the liver's job. Okay, so it's hard on the body. It causes so many complications possibly for your patient that we don't want them on it very long. Number six is, which one is going to be best for a client who has a facial trauma? Which one is going to be best for a client with a facial trauma? Well, you know what that's going to be? That's going to be enteral nutrition. Yes, because guess what this patient has? Even if your face is totally smashed in, guess what you still have? A functioning GI tract. If your gastrointestinal tract is working, I'm not giving you TPN. You can get a G-tube. You can get a J-tube. You can eat through enteral nutrition. All right, so I hope that makes sense. Number seven, if the client has a lower spinal cord injury, let me tell you something else. It will also be enteral nutrition. Yes, and actually, there's been studies that show that patients with spinal cord injury, lower spinal cord injuries, they actually do better when their enteral nutrition is started sooner than later. All right. And so it helps them to keep their protein levels up. And it's a very, very valuable option for them. Okay. Number eight says, the client with small bowel transplantation. All right. Your small bowel has been transplanted. What do you think is going to be best for you? Yeah, for this one, for TPN, TPN on a short-term basis is going to be best for this patient. All right. Number nine says, hey, the client is terminally ill, but they're requesting nutritional support because they believe they can make a recovery. So they want the nutritional support. They think they're going to recover. What's going to be best for them? It'll be the enteral nutrition. All right. And our choices are enteral and TPN here. So don't say oral. It's enteral or TPN. All right. So enteral nutrition is going to be best for this patient. Okay. And then number 10, hey, client is expected to have liver failure. Oh my goodness. What do we want to put this patient on? We want to put this patient on a enteral nutrition. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so you guys should be feeling extra confident now about your oral antidiabetics, your insulins, and your TPNs. We have been talking about how to keep our patients maintained through medical interventions, but it's not over yet because you get to get a sneak peek of the virtual trainer. We're gonna be talking about diets, which is so appropriate for our lecture today. All right, so check it out. Hey there, thank you so much for joining me for our third Harvard, Remar, Nurse University. I hope we can continue studying in the virtual trainer. This year is all about you getting your license, and I'm going to help you do that. So if you're feeling confident, if you're feeling ready to take on the NCLEX beast, let me help you get the other half of the way with the content from the test plan. Pharmacology, you can dominate it. Let's dominate the rest of the subjects that will be on your NCLEX exam. I can't wait for our next class and, of course, to see you with your license. You can, you will, you must pass NCLEX. But now I'm going to take you inside of our virtual trainer, just like I promised. So I have taken a page out of our NCLEX virtual trainer student workbook and put it in your downloadable workbook. So when we go inside the virtual trainer, you will be able to see what it's like to study with the full comprehensive NCLEX review. You can get this program done in 3 to 6 weeks. Let's check it out. Welcome to the Remar Review Virtual Trainer, the future of nursing education. Here we have a fully customizable, immersive, and interactive experience to accelerate learning. Here at Remar Review, we believe that every nursing student can pass NCLEX when they are connected to the right study materials. Effective studying will not only increase knowledge, but also confidence for students who need to study in a flexible learning environment at a reasonable cost. And the best part is that I guarantee the nursing students will actually enjoy studying. With our full motion videos and user participation, we have created a one-of-a-kind immersive environment that will take education and assessment to the next level. Mobile interface, dynamic exhibits, file vaults, social media integration, report cards, and user certificates. Before I go, let me say that our goal here is to have your complete satisfaction. We are excited to partner with you on this journey to help you pass NCLEX. Therapeutic diets are really important to know for your exam. We're going to talk about several kinds of diets, the reason why patients are prescribed them, and the foods that they can or cannot have. Let's start with the easiest diet, the NPO, or nothing by mouth diet. The reason why patients are prescribed to be NPO is to prevent aspiration before surgery. So if you're going for a surgical procedure and you happen to get nauseated by the anesthesia or the stress of the procedure, if you don't have anything in your stomach, you're less likely to aspirate. Another reason why patients can be prescribed NPO is to have bowel rest. That means you give your intestines a break from constantly digesting food. When it comes to the food, you cannot have anything by mouth. This is very important for nursing students to remember because NPO means NPO. That means no food, no medications, no water, nothing by mouth. The next diet is the clear liquid diet. The indication for this diet is to prevent dehydration. Liquids that are acceptable in the clear liquid diet are water, juices, see-through broths, gelatin, coffee, and tea. The next diet is the full liquid diet. The full liquid diet is also used to prevent dehydration, but it's not the first diet after surgery. You have the clear liquids first, and then you move to a full liquid if you can tolerate the liquid clear diet. Now, in the full liquid diet, the liquids, you cannot see through them. So, our food examples are ice cream, milk, puddings. These are liquids that have an opaque color. You can't see through them. Hot cereals can also be included in the full liquid diet, such as wheat cereals or oatmeal can be made to a liquid consistency.
The next diet is the puree diet. This diet is for small babies or clients who are unable to chew, clients who have dysphagia. So chewing and swallowing are very difficult. Now, for the puree diet, any food that can be blended or mashed to a smooth consistency is acceptable. Now, a nursing point is even if a patient is on a puree diet and they're able to have several different foods, you want to keep those foods separate when feeding them. Just because a client is on a puree diet, that doesn't mean that we are going to mix mashed potatoes and peas and carrots all into one dish and serve them. For NCLEX, you want to keep each one of those foods separately when feeding your patient for the value of the taste of the food. If the food doesn't taste good because it's all mixed together, then the client more than likely won't eat it. The next diet is the mechanical soft diet. This diet is really popular for patients who have difficulty chewing specifically. Perhaps they have poor fitted dentures or missing teeth, or they cannot chew their food thoroughly. So when it comes to the mechanical soft diet, again, any food that can be easily broken down for the patient can be included, but no nuts or no seeds can ever be considered a mechanical soft diet. The bland diet is next. This diet is used to decrease gastric irritation or discomfort. So bland foods are all about keeping the stomach calm. So for example, clients who have ulcers of the stomach or clients who have a lot of stomach acid production, we give them the bland diet alternative. When it comes to bland foods, there's a lot of grains and vegetables that you can have. So what I want to focus on is what you cannot have. And for the bland diet, you cannot have any fatty, fried, or spicy food. Also, you need to avoid CAP. And CAP stands for caffeine, alcohol, and peppers. Our protein restricted diet is next. Protein restriction is all for our renal patients. I want you to remember that combination. And the food that you need to avoid are animal products. So meats, poultry or chicken, and fish. Does anyone know what is really the problem with animal foods? And why do our renal patients have a hard time with protein? Can you think? Well, let me tell you. When you eat an animal product and it is not broken down and it is not excreted out of your body, then that animal product will begin to ferment in the body. And so what happens is the animal product turns into ammonia, and ammonia is a toxin for our body. So if a patient has a compromised renal system, then they're not able to filter out all of the ammonia, and so the patients will start to become sick and they will start to be confused as the ammonia levels in their body increases. So clients who have renal issues, we tell them to avoid those animal products and make sure that they have a very tight control on how much protein that they're getting. Sodium restricted are for our heart patients. We all know that limiting the sodium intake is heart healthy. And so what you may see is a 2 gram or a 1 gram sodium restricted diet. For the sodium restricted diet, clients need to avoid canned food, because canned meats and canned soups, they use salt as a preservative to keep the food safe. So Again, for a client who's trying to avoid sodium, they have to stay away from food in cans, also frozen food or salted food, again, tends to be high in sodium. The next diet is the high fiber diet. The reason why a patient is on a high fiber diet is to prevent constipation. Think about our clients who are on bed rest or immobile. They tend to be constipated, so the high fiber diet would really help them. The high fiber foods include whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. Low purine is used for our clients with gout, and gout is a form of arthritis. Now, if you need to avoid foods that have purine in them, I want you to think of seafood. Seafood is super high in purine, so clients who have gout or on a low purine diet should avoid fish, scallops, sardines, and anchovies. The next diet is the high protein diet. This diet is for our elderly clients and also our clients who have burns on their skin. Just like we were talking about low protein, high protein foods include red meat, fish, and beans. So this will be the focus of the high protein diet. Many of us are familiar with the diabetic diet. It's the next one. The indication is to control blood glucose levels. You know, for NCLEX, the diabetic diet is really a healthy diet with a variety of foods. But specifically for our diabetic patients, we need to teach them that 50% of their meals should be carbohydrates. And the reason why good carbohydrates are recommended is because carbohydrates help keep the blood sugar stable for a long period of time, as opposed to proteins or fats. So 50% of their meal should be a carbohydrate. 20% should be a protein, and about 30% should be a fat, 30% or less. Diabetic clients should avoid simple sugars such as pastries, candies, that instance. You definitely want to know about celiac's diet. The indication for the celiac's diet is to avoid gluten. Clients need to be on a gluten-free diet, and gluten is actually a protein found in most grains. So for NCLEX, clients should avoid the grain that has the acronym BROW, B-R-O-W. Have you heard that before? BROW stands for barley, rye, oats, and wheat. Barley, rye, oats, and wheat. But you know what? NCLEX, they're not going to ask you about barley, rye, oats, and wheat. They're going to say, can your client with celiac disease have bread? What are you going to say? You're going to say, no, absolutely not, because bread comes from wheat. They're going to ask you, can your client have spaghetti? And you're going to have to say, no, because spaghetti comes from wheat as well. It's a pasta. It comes from wheat. They're going to ask you if your client can have a pie. If they asked about pie, what are you going to say? You're going to say no, because the crust of that pie has gluten in it. It's the same for cookies. No to cookies, no to waffles, no to pancakes. All right. So everything has to be gluten-free for this patient. Well, those are our therapeutic diets for the exam. Let's keep studying.
So you can see what it's like to study with the full review. And remember, this is a program that you can do in 3 to 6 weeks from your computer, your tablet, your phone, or even your smart TV. So yes, this is the opportunity for you to get your license.
Videos, and I would repeat those videos and that. Hey, okay, calm down. I am now a nurse, and I'd like to say thank you so much for giving us the content, and content really does matter, so thank you so much. and I'll see you for RN. Bye.
Hi, Regina. Hi, Wimar crew. Hi, Wimar nurses. My name is Brislyn Dennett. I'm from Haiti. I've been here in the U.S. for 12 years. I studied as a CNA for six months, PCT, LPN for 5 years. I went to take my test last week. I took 2 weeks off from work, studied a virtual trainer. I didn't really do a lot of questions, like Regina said. I was focused on content. Most questions that I did is only the one in virtual trainer. The day I went to take my test, I prayed. I said, God, I'm not gonna lean on my own understanding. I'm gonna lean on your own understanding. And I said, God, I'm leaving my home as an LPN, but I'm coming back as a RN. I went in my car, took my stuff, went in my car. I prayed, and then I called my husband. I was crying. My husband was like, why are you crying? Don't you know who God is? You did your part. You studied. So now let God do his part. I'm like, okay then. So from the place to my home in my car, I was praying, worshiping God. I did not do the trick. No, I was scared. So I waited for 2 days. I went on person view, pay for the quick result, and guess what? When I saw the word pass, I went crazy. I was running in my home, in my house, crying like a mad woman. I'm telling you. But God did it. God intervened. I'm telling you. Wima is the key. Content is the key. Listen to what Regina said. I'm telling you, she was right. If you don't know your content, you won't be able to answer those questions. I was able to answer most of the questions because of Wima, because of Regina, because she took her time to explain every detail. Regina, you are awesome. You are great. You are the best of the best. Thank you so much for your time, for your patience. I want to tell you right now, I'm asking God to bless you, to bless your family, to bless your ministry, to give you strength. Don't ever, don't get discouraged. Let me tell you, because you are blessing a lot of people. You are blessing a lot of people out there. I'm telling you. Thank you so much. And Wimar nurses, do not get discouraged. Continue to study, focus, follow Wimar. Virtual trainer is the key. I'm telling you, it's the key. And then remember, with God, nothing is impossible. Pray and study, and you will see. If I can do it, you can do it. Okay? Love you guys. Take care.
Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know the fun is not over yet. You have another class. So I can't wait to see you again. Set your reminders so you don't miss it. We are getting into that content. We are focusing on the test plan information and nothing else. I'm having an awesome time. Remember, yes, you can study my program and get your license in 3 to 6 weeks. This is your opportunity to pass NCLEX and get your license. I'm so excited for you guys. Also, listen, like, share, subscribe to this channel so you don't miss any of my new videos. I can't wait for you to get your nursing license. I need you to believe that. Say our motto at Wimar Review is simply, I can, I will, I must pass NCLEX. Can you say that with me? I can, I will, I must pass NCLEX. One more time, say it like you mean it. I can, I will, and I must pass NCLEX. See you later, guys.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.